And welcome to Newfigen. I am Irina, and today I am talking to Massimiliano Smania, who has recently finished his PhD in quantum information at Stockholm University.
Hello.
Hi. We worked in the same group and on quite similar topics, though we never worked together. So we will refer the listeners every now and then to the episode about my research, since the theoretical notions go together.
Yes. Hopefully everyone has listened to that.
But you don't need to have listened to any previous episodes to be able to follow Massi's work. So let's start, as we usually do, with a discussion about the way your work is placed in the field, which is physics and quantum physics, and the way it's placed in the world, I suppose. What was the aim of your thesis?
The aim of my thesis was a dual aim, so both trying to approach and tackle some of the issues in the field of quantum information and also explore new tools that are now coming up in the field.
So you worked on both older established problems that needed pushing forward and on new, entirely new things.
Exactly.
So why is it important that we do these things?
Besides, of course, the fundamental aspect of knowing more about the universe, we, in this case, we had more applied outcomes of the research. So you might have heard that there's a lot of focus on quantum technologies at the moment. And this is the broader background into which my thesis can be explained.
So your work has direct applications in technologies?
It's still not at that stage, but there are related works that have already been applied also in commercial scenarios. So I would say that, yes, there are commercial and technological aspects of it.
So what are some quantum technologies that are close to being realized or being realized now?
We've all heard about quantum computing, but that's maybe not so close to being realized, although there are proof of principles already. But softer version of it, which is called quantum simulation, can already be realized in the lab. And that would be simulating, for example, chemical systems or physical systems with quantum computation platforms. And then there's all the whole communication aspect of it. So, for example, if you've heard about quantum key distribution or in general quantum communication protocols.
And what would these quantum technologies mean for, I don't know, for our lives or for our technology?
That's a good question. So this is not just an incremental change in the technology that we use for communication, for example, but it's really a new paradigm. It's like going from using horses for traction to a combustion engine. It's a whole new level of communication and computation.
I see. So then I imagine that there is like a lot at stake for countries, I suppose, to be ahead of this development and to be the innovators.
Yes, depending on who you ask, this quantum race is really seen in a competitive way. There are governments involved because this can give significant advantages from the point of communication and secure communication, and also computational power, which is, of course, interesting to both governments and industry.
But you've also mentioned the fundamental aspect, and this is what I want to go back to now, fundamental notions in quantum mechanics that we need to kind of understand in order to dive into your work and into the technology. I suppose one of the key notions that we should understand is the qubit or the quantum bit. And I propose we start from there. What is a qubit?
So we're all familiar with a bit, a classical bit, which is the basic unit of information in information technology. It has two possible states, 0 or 1, which are on or off. The quantum bit is just the equivalent in the quantum technologies. So a quantum bit can, or a qubit for short, can also be 0 or 1. But it also has a very special property that it can be in a what we call a superposition of the states 0 and 1.
What is a superposition?
A specifically quantum property of a system. It means that the qubit is neither in state 0 or 1, but also at the same time both in state 0 or 1. This is one of the counterintuitive notions that we always hear about in quantum physics.
So that means there are three states, 0, 1, and both 0 and 1?
That's exactly part of the difficulty of explaining it, right? So there aren't three states, neither two states. There is a continuous spectrum of states. So a good way to picture it is usually in a geometric way. We can imagine that a qubit is a point, or the state of a qubit is described by a point in a sphere, which can be both on the surface or inside a three-dimensional sphere. The state of the qubit can be anywhere in the sphere. This is incidentally called a Bloch sphere.
That is a very neat image, as we said also in episode 9. It can help you intuitively to understand also the complexity of the problem of telling things about qubits, because a sphere is actually quite big. In the project that we will focus on, we will see that you were interested in using qubits for something that is called the Bell test. So let's get this out of the way. What is a Bell test?
So in order to understand Bell tests, we need to go back a bit and talk about a paradox that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen came up with in the 30s, where basically they claimed that following the principles of quantum mechanics, we get to a situation where either quantum mechanics is incomplete as a theory, or we in nature have what Einstein called a spooky action at a distance.
Being complete for a theory means that it describes all properties of the physical system, not just part of the world.
Exactly, and this is where Bell's theorem came into play. So in the 60s, Bell figured out a way to test whether the nature that surrounds us can be described by what Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen thought to be a complete theory, which would be, for example, classical theories, or the uncertainty and probabilistic nature that we find in quantum mechanics is actually intrinsic to reality.
So the Bell test is a test of whether classical theory is good enough. It's a negative test against classical theory, and it can help us to refute it and then strengthen our belief that it is quantum theory that we should have in place.
Exactly.
And this test was in some sense a quantitative test. It came with a value that some experiment would have to meet in order to disprove classical theory as sufficient. This was then implemented in an experiment, and the results came back. This was in the 70s, and the results came back that indeed what you see in the world, or in this case in a highly controlled lab, but what you see is incompatible with classical theory. But in your work, you are not revisiting this dilemma. You are not trying to refute classical theory. You use Bell tests in a different way. Can you explain?
Exactly. So in my work, we use Bell tests to prove that the systems that we are dealing with in the experiment are quantum systems and cannot be described by classical theories.
So it is less about what is generally a good description of the world, because by now we believe quite strongly that quantum mechanics is good or at least useful. It's about whether the system that you are probing is quantum rather than classical.
Yes, so there is a leap of faith involved, right? The theorem discards the possibility of classical mechanics, but then after that we add the logical step of assuming that because it's not classical, the system is quantum.
What is the system? Because in my case, for example, I always talk about the system in the abstract. There's always just the sphere that I'm interested in and points on the sphere and so on. But you worked in a lab, so your quantum system must be something in the real world. What is it?
Yes, that's a very good question. The system that we used were photons, which are particles of light, basically. And in particular, so when we say we use quantum information, we encode the information on a property that these photons have. And in our case, it was the polarization of a photon.
By encoding the information, you mean that this property is the one that has values in the sphere that we've described as the qubit.
Exactly. So like a bit can be on or off, a qubit can be in states 0 and or 1, as we said, and various superpositions. And we use polarization states of light in order to encode this information.
What is polarization?
Polarization is one of the properties of a electromagnetic wave, like light. It can be imagined in terms of waves as, imagine a pond of water where you have a stick floating. If you throw a rock in the water, you will have waves. When the waves reach the stick will start moving up and down. The up and down movement, so the vertical direction, is the polarization of the waves. This polarization can take different directions, and this is what we use to encode information. Polarization of light is also used commonly everywhere. One example is the 3D glasses that we have at the movie theater, where the two lenses work with opposite polarization of light.
Okay, so your system is then optics. It uses lenses and mirrors and things that are quite common, and we have quite a lot of experience working with.
Yes, exactly. So the actual instrumentation that we use in the lab is that typical of optics experiments. So as you said, yes, mirrors, pieces of glass which we call wave plates, and detectors for light and lasers.
So what was your background going into this PhD?
My background is in physics. I studied physics for my bachelor and my master's degree. I ended up in this particular field because I did my master's thesis in Erasmus exchange program and chose this group because I was interested in the field, and then I just kept going for my PhD.
And how was it to do a PhD? As you expected, or?
It was certainly hard. I am sure I experienced the most rewarding and most depressing and frustrating times during my PhD. But I guess this is common to all disciplines.
What did you enjoy the most about it?
Even though I am an experimental physicist, I have to admit that what I enjoyed the most were the discussions about theory, whiteboard discussions with colleagues and semi-strangers. These are really cool because they can bring together people who have extremely diverse backgrounds but share a common subject they work on.
And then were the research questions that you worked in the PhD, were they fixed, or were they somewhat influenced by all these discussions that you mentioned, or how much freedom did you have actually?
So my projects were definitely influenced by the discussions that I had with colleagues and my supervisor. I had quite a lot of freedom in choosing my projects, which can of course be both a positive and negative aspect. In the end, I think most of the projects that I worked on were things that were ideas that were lying around in the group and that I was fascinated by and that were very current at the time.
And did all of them work out?
Of course not. Some of them did and resulted in published articles. Others were dropped.
That is very often the case. How did a normal working day look for you?
I wouldn't say I had a really working schedule day in, day out, but most days consisted in reading up emails and some bureaucratic work and then going to the lab, because I was still an experimental physicist. And finally, towards the evening, work on some theory, which was the background of the experiment, or working on publishing papers.
I will change gear now and ask you in more detail about the research that you're doing in these days. So let's go back to the Bell tests. And you say that there are these tests that we can use to check whether our system is compatible with classical mechanics or if it is quantum. More specifically, how does such a test look like?
So a Bell test normally includes a source of particles and two measurement stations, which are spatially separated, which are traditionally called Alice and Bob. The source of particles emits what we call entangled particles. These entangled particles are then, as we said, separated and sent to Alice and Bob, who perform measurements on them and extract probabilities from their measurements.
So I guess a central notion that you need for this is entanglement. You said entangled particles. What is entanglement?
In my opinion, entanglement is the single most fascinating aspect of quantum mechanics, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this. We can define entanglement by negatives. So we say that a quantum state, which is made up of two or more subsystems, is entangled if the state of the subsystems cannot be written separately from the state of the whole system.
So in your case, when you have an entangled system, you mean two photons or more photons, but let's say two photons that are entangled. And then this system, because it is a system consisting of two photons, has an overall state. But you cannot write this as the collection of the state of the individual photons.
Exactly. So in my case of two photons or two qubits, we say that these two qubits are entangled if the state that describes them cannot be written as a product of the states of the two qubits independently.
And you have a source that gives out entangled photons that then travel to Alice and Bob, who do measurements. You were talking about them collecting probabilities. How do you measure probability?
So first of all, we should say that the measurement process is still one of the big open problems in quantum mechanics. That said, when we perform a measurement in practice with photons, what we do is we try to characterize or determine the polarization of these photons, right, which is our information carrier, and we send them to photon detectors, which send out a electrical signal, or as we say, a click, whenever a photon gets to them. Out of these detectors, we count how many times we had one outcome rather than another, and then from that we can extract experimental probabilities.
So basically you collect probabilities by doing the same thing over and over again and then measuring how many times some result happened.
This is an important point. Bell tests are statistical tests. They're not single shot tests of one entangled state. They're repeated hundreds of thousands or millions of times.
That is very interesting, and it sounds like a lot of work to implement in practice. So in your project, why did you use a Bell test? What did you want to know?
As we said before, Bell tests can exclude classical theory, and in a way they have been used, or they're used now, to prove that the experiment that we are doing is using quantum particles rather than classical particles. This enables a whole lot of futures that are not accessible whenever you have classical particles. For example, in our case, we were interested in proving or certifying, as we say, a property of the system that we're using or of the measurement apparatus while making no assumption whatsoever on the devices that we used. So the thing is that we can assume these devices are black boxes, and thanks to quantum physics, we can still certify certain properties of our experiment.
What were the properties that you wanted to certify?
So in particular, in one of the projects that I did, we were interested in certifying that a very special measurement was performed on our qubits. This is called the SICK measurement, and it's exactly what you talked about in episode 9.
This is a symmetric informationally complete measurement, which it's a quite special object, and then you are interested in seeing whether you can guarantee that your device is doing this measurement. What Bell tests did you use for this?
So Bell tests are a class of experiments. There are many different Bell tests. The one we used was particularly fit for the outcome that we were aiming for, which was certifying this special measurement. In particular, we know from your explanation that the CPOVM for qubits is depicted as a regular tetrahedron on the Bloch sphere. The Bell test that we used has measurements which are also a tetrahedron on the Bloch sphere.
Just to remind everyone, a tetrahedron is a geometric object with four faces, all of which are triangles. And this is a regular tetrahedron we are talking about, so all the faces are equal. And when you inscribe it in the sphere, it's as spaced out as four points can be on the surface of a sphere. These are the CPOVMs, and this is what you're interested in certifying or in checking their presence in your system. Why is that interesting?
CPOVMs have been known for a long time to be optimal. Any case where we want to transmit information between parties or reconstruct quantum states.
So then it is valuable to know whether your experimental setup is performing this measurement. You probe it with this test to find if that's the case. Going back to Bell tests a bit, you say that these are tests, statistical tests, where classical mechanics allows you a certain value and quantum mechanics predicts a larger one. Then passing the test means that you get a value that is above the one allowed by classical theory.
Exactly. Classical physics predicts a value which is lower than results that can be obtained with quantum mechanics. So we have what we call a classical bound, which is the maximum value that we can reach in the experiment with a classical system. and we have a higher quantum bound, which is the best result that quantum mechanics predicts.
So there is a quantum bound. You cannot obtain any value in quantum theory either for these tests. And certification, is it sufficient that you are above the classical limit, or do you have to be at the quantum limit?
This is a very interesting question. Originally, Bell tests had nothing to do with quantum mechanics. The point was that if you had a value which was higher than the classical bound in the experiment, then you had to refute classical mechanics. Nowadays, Bell tests are used to probe the quantumness of systems. Then it becomes interesting to try and reach the quantum bound and verify the predictions of quantum mechanics.
What would happen if you went above the quantum bound?
Scientific progress would happen, because you would have to look for a theory better than quantum mechanics to explain the result.
So you're striving for reaching the quantum bound, actually, in your experiment. Is that necessary for certification?
The simple answer is yes, but there's more to that. So the quantum bound is an ideal result, which, because of experimental noise, can actually never be achieved in the lab. Any quantum information protocol that relies on reaching the quantum bound has to take into account experimental noise. In our case, we did not reach the quantum bound, but we had a result which was high enough to certify that the measurement that we were performing was an informationally complete measurement, although not a symmetric one.
So even if you don't hit the bound, you are still able to certify some properties of your measurement. Can you clarify a bit what you managed to certify?
With the almost optimal result that we obtained in the lab, very close to the quantum bound, we were able to certify that our measurement was an informationally complete one, which is arguably the most interesting feature of the measurement that we were trying to perform. In particular, yes, we could certify this property. We could not certify that the measurement was symmetric, so the ideal regular tetrahedron on the sphere. And we also couldn't tell how close we were to that measurement.
When you say that you treated your devices as black boxes and made no assumptions about them, that refers both to the detectors and to the source in this scenario. But in another project, even though we said we're not going into all of them, but this one is quite connected, in another project, you were able to tell how close you are to sick POVMs. How does that work?
So in another subsequent project, we looked at a similar scenario, but in a simpler way. I said that we can draw our conclusions while assuming that our devices are black boxes that we don't know anything about. This is very useful in certain cases, but it also makes simulating the experimental results very complicated. So if we add an additional assumption on our source of particles, for example, we assume that it's emitting qubits, then we can go much farther in simulating our experiments. And in that case, we were able to not only certify that the measurement that we performed on the qubit was a informationally complete one, but also how close we were to the ideal sick.
So then you are describing two experiments that in some sense complement each other, because in the one that where you could get more information about the measurement, you had to make assumptions about the source. And in the other one, you could also treat the source as a black box, but then you'd get less information about the measurement. So this is interesting because each of these results has practical implications on its own, so they stand on themselves, but also together they paint a bit of a picture of what you can tell.
Yes, in the end it depends on what your aim is. In a more, let's say, application-oriented case, you want to make as little assumptions on the devices as you want, so maybe the first project that we talked about is more interesting. On the other hand, if you want to explore the possibilities of the theoretical modeling of your system, then the second scenario, which is simpler, is more interesting.
So what do you see as the follow-up of your research?
In terms of the projects that we discussed, I would say that a short-term follow-up would be to improve our modeling of the experimental setup that we use in order to make this test more reliable in view of a future application in the real world. from a broader perspective, the future of the quantum communication field will be outside academia, outside the labs. There are already projects which are ongoing in different parts of the world, including China and Europe, where people are trying to implement quantum networks, which are just like telecommunication networks that we know now, but using quantum systems.
This still sounds a bit sci-fi to me, but I agree that this is the vision of the future that makes a vision of the future that makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Masi, for talking to me about these subjects that we both hold very dear.
Thank you, Irina, and it was my pleasure.
Goodbye. You listened to Neufiken. This was Irina speaking with Massimiliano, who has finished his PhD at the Department of Physics at Stockholm University. If you want to know more about Massimiliano's research, you can find more information at our webpage, neufiken.co. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook as Curious Neufiken in one word. This episode of Neufiken was published in November 2020.